Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
This is Patricia Camilleri, welcoming you to University Matters on Campus FM. In this series, together, we shall continue to discover more about the work of the university's academics and about the many activities that will be taking place on campus over the next year. It is always my pleasure to have with me on University Matters and Campus FM, Professor Peter Bassando. I'm embarking today on a mini-series about the Department of English, during which I shall be speaking to individual members of staff about their work, about their teaching, about their research, and who better to speak to first than Professor Bassando. He has been an inspiration and a mainstay of the department, of course, for many years. I should, on this occasion, give a little short bio. He's obviously a professor of English literature. He was head of the department from 1998 to 2006. He read an English honours degree at the University of Malta, where he was awarded the British Council Prize for English Studies. He continued his studies as a Commonwealth Scholar and Fellow at the University of Oxford, where he obtained the degrees of MA and DPhil. Professor Bassando has recently been elected Fellow of the English Association. His publications include Byron, The Italian Literary Influence, and Byron and the Mediterranean, which he edited. He is a member of the Board of Directors of the International Byron Society and sits on the advisory editorial board of La Questione Romantica of Bologna and Romanticism, a journal that's out of Edinburgh. Professor Bassando is founding editor of the Journal of Anglo-Italian Studies, now it has reached 11 volumes, no less, and is currently chair of the Institute of Anglo-Italian Studies, which promotes advanced research in this interdisciplinary field of study. He's published articles on the major Romantic poets and has written a section on Romantic narrative verse in Romanticism, an Oxford guide, edited by Nicholas Rowe. That's Oxford University Press, of course. He has been a visiting professor at some of the leading British and Italian universities and has been invited as keynote speaker at major conferences. He's currently president of the International Association of University Professors of English, and he has recently completed a study of Yeats's poetry for the forthcoming The New Cambridge History of English Poetry, edited by Michael O'Neill. Welcome to University Matters, Professor Bassando.
Thank you very much.
Well, we're going to be talking about the growth of the Department of English, the growth of the teaching of English and also linguistics at university level over the past 50 years. But perhaps we can go back a little bit further than that and just mention some of the earlier efforts in the early part of the 20th century to really place English on the academic map here at the university.
Yes, perhaps I go far back to Eric Shepherd, who is professor here, who wrote a very interesting book, and amusing too, called Malta and Me, recounting his experiences as professor and as somebody who lived like the island and lived on the island, and he particularly liked Gozo. Shepherd writes about the difficulty of teaching English to students at the time when there was a very strong political crisis. It was after the Sector Junior riots. The students had taken part. They were almost antagonistic towards English because they were the language of culture and university was Italian. And so he had to teach against the grain. It was very difficult to keep them. It took him about 20 minutes to get them to sit down and listen to it in those days. And it would be extremely amusing and about his experiences. And I think he would be the first person to mention.
I love his description of Thames and Meads.
Yes, well, Thames and Meads had impressed him very much. Because although he was brought over by the colonial administration, he got to like Malta and the Maltese, and that explains the book. And he admired certain Maltese people who rose above the rest. And Temis Amici was one of them. Another one was Masut Bonnici, Carmelo, I think, known as Il Gross, father of former President Ugo Masut Bonnici and former Chief Justice, Justice Emeritus. Joe Jonas Bonnici, who was a remarkable man, and he stood out, of course, and Eric Shepherd liked them both. Then I can go on. I think history is important now, because I am a great believer in the historical past. Everything has a history. If you discount the history, you are just talking in a vacuum. And this is why I always say, things have developed, and you have to see how they developed. Well, our own island, let's put it this way, has developed from being an island under the hegemony of the knights, to the coming of the French, to the British colonialism, and then to independence. So there's always a history, and it's vitally important to know that. Now, I feel that, and this part of the history is the people, the personalities who make it. With the University of Malta, English department, there was a personality, Owen Fogarty, who was eccentric, who was a big man, and had was very opinionated. But I think he taught politics rather than English, because though he taught the English canonical writers, such as Newman in those days, because I think with a Catholic bias, because it was like that, the policy was like that. He also provoked students into making political statements. And my father used to recall, he was a student of Fogarty's, that halfway through, say, something on Milton, he would then stop the lecture for a moment. Now, what do you think about free will and predestination? And he just jolts the students into having a kind of reaction. After Fogarty, there was, who died suddenly, he lived in a hotel in Valletta. There was Alan Bliss, a quiet scholar, a very fine scholar. He was a medieval scholar who produced the standard edition of Sir Orfeo, a medieval text, a Breton lay translated into English. But and I remember at Oxford he was highly regarded as a medievalist. He was a shy man who had a slight stammer, and instead of addressing students directly, he would just look out of the window.
Just like eye contact.
Yes, I think it's part of the shyness. And then after the Bliss, there was Donald Sultana, who was a lecturer, a senior lecturer, took over as acting head of the department, a kind of caretaker. And then council appointed an Englishman from St. Andrews, Richard James Beck, Professor Beck, who then came over and reorganized the department entirely.
Certainly a name that I've heard many, many times. Yeah. I don't remember him myself, of course, but his name echoes in the corridors of the university to this day.
There will be many, many teachers who will, I'm sure, will remember him and his lectures. He was a good scholar, especially on Chaucer and Milton. Those were his forte. Chaucer, he would combine erudition with a sense of humor. So, for example, let's say in the comic tales of Chaucer, Fertilote and husband Chanticleer, the tale of a fox and a hen. It's not about a fox and a hen at all. It's not the fable. It's about a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, a pompous husband and a practical wife. And the cock has a dream that a red bushy tail is going to kill him. And, of course, the wife tells him, oh, that's a dream, nonsense. I mean, come on, Nick, you've had too much sweet yesterday. Take a laxative and all that. And there's this quarrel between husband and wife, which is delightful, really. And, of course, the husband sort of feels superior because he's pompous, he's very macho and very male, and he buries under some Latin quotations, which he then mistranslates, for example, mulier est omnis confusio. Madam, the sentence of this Latin is, woman is man's joy and all his bliss, which is not quite quite a good translation. And Beck says, love this part. And then he talks, related to his own marital situation, which he hyped up, of course. And he said about domestic life and domestic bliss, and he and his wife sometimes had a little bit of an argument or quarrel about whether they should go to the film, just to watch a film, or to go to the theatre, which his wife wanted to do. So in the end, we compromised and went to the theatre. That kind of, he had a very wry sense of humour, very ironical, and one would always remember his lectures, I'm sure. I sat as a student and I was absolutely delighted.
And he wasn't just a good lecturer,
no,
I gather.
No, yeah.
He was also an extremely efficient administrator, which is a wonderful combination.
Yes, a rare combination, because lecturers on the whole, professors aren't absent-minded and not very good at administration. He was excellent. He brought over, with the help of the British Council at the time, they collaborated a lot, lecturers from abroad, people like David Farley Hills, you may remember. He came over and taught. David taught Rochester and the poetry and the 18th century. And he also produced plays, some plays, with the students taking part. I think, if I remember, Mary Gallia de Buono, she took part in Arnold Wesker's The Kitchen. And her husband Joe, now the judge, and David himself married a Maltese girl, one of his students, Marlene, and we remained friends. Then Donald, after a while, having obtained his doctorate from Oxford, had the honour of being appointed, Donald Sultan I'm talking about, of being appointed reader in English literature at the University of Edinburgh. It's a great achievement.
Of course.
And when he left, of course, Beck turned to me and said, you were his sort of student for romantic literature. Will you set up the course on romantic literature and develop it? Which I did. And I've been teaching that for the past many years, of course. And so that was that. And then, of course, the department developed more. The language part was developed too. Philip Riley was brought over from Reading. He developed the language lab and phonetics and the linguistics part of it, which is also part of the whole department, language and literature. And then, of course, we had other local Maltese lecturers coming over and being appointed. There was myself, there was Daniel Musser, there was Lydia Shriha on the language side, and so on. And now, of course, we've become quite a big department in the Faculty of Art.
Yes, of course.
Because we have so many students, which is a good thing.
And another thing that he did, if I heard understood correctly, was he brought in the idea of having to bring an external examiner.
Yes, that's vitally important. Well, he was enlightened in this way. He said, Malta is a small place, and everybody knows everybody else, and everybody's almost related, cousins of cousins and friends of friends. So he said the best thing to do would be to get an external to assess and validate the degree. And this is what he did. And the first external examiner who came over, with the help of the British Council at the time, who financed part of his visit, was Ian Jack, Professor Ian Jack, who was Professor of Romantic Literature at the University of Cambridge. A very high-powered professor, and very well-known, and he interviewed one student, an honor student, and that student was me. And he came and he said, well, I've come all the way from Cambridge, I'm going to imitate his voice, I've come all the way from Cambridge, Mr. Vassallo, and I'm now going to give you a good run for your money.
Excellent.
It was about, the live was about 1 hour and 20 minutes.
So he gave you a hard time?
He gave me not a hard time, but he gave me the opportunity to show what I knew.
Absolutely.
Eventually, that served me a lot, served me good stead, because when I eventually applied to do my doctorate at Oxford, I asked him for a testimonial, and it was an excellent testimonial, so that helped him enormously.
Of course, because he really knew.
He could say from experience, I've examined this man. The most important thing, we've had many important external examiners, one after another, every 2 or 3 years. John Lawler, from Canterbury, and John Carey from Oxford. John Carey, incidentally, has written a book on his autobiography called The Unexpected Professor, which is his own life, his own academic life. There's a lot about Oxford there. I think he does mention being external in here. And I think we became very good friends eventually. And he came over to Malta as one of my keynote speakers for the conference, you know, the Association of International Professors of English Conference.
Another name I recognize from the list is Timothy Webb.
Yes, Timothy Webb. Yes, Timothy Webb from Bristol. He's a romantic scholar, an expert on Shelley. We're friends, of course, very good friends. And that's how, this is so important for us not to be in so-called splendid isolation, the island mentality. Now, I always say you cannot live off your own fat here only, intellectually. You've got to go abroad and you've got to make contact with universities abroad and your peers abroad. And he was one of them. Michael O'Neill from Durham was another, also an expert on Shelley and the Romantics. And Nick Rowe came over recently, Nicholas Rowe from St. Andrews, who is, I think, the foremost expert on Keats. He's written a wonderful biography of about 500 pages on Keats, every detail of his life, not only details, but they're interesting criticism to thrown in, as it were, en passant.
So this system of external examiners, which is, in fact, pervasive throughout the University of Malta, is a way of, in one way, benchmarking the standards of our students, but also a wonderful way, as you say, of networking with people with excellent reputations who can really, really enrich the lecturers themselves and the students, of course.
Yes, yeah, that's absolutely true. In fact, to begin with, it was the external examiner was not only assessing students and the program, he was assessing us indirectly.
Quite so.
And that's good. In fact, now Oxford and Cambridge are introducing an external examiner from other universities. Against the grain, a lot of objection to it, but they had to. It's part of validation of your courses. You have to validate your courses.
They considered themselves the top of the pile.
Oxford were always Olympian. And how dare these mortals come over?
Quite so.
They were like that. But now they've had to accept. And so the most important thing about the external exam, however, was that at the last line, as it were, the last paragraph, would have to say was that the, and this is the way they normally finish, that the best students they've examined were on a par with the best students in their university. Now that is the best, let's say, the best credentials you can get.
Of course. Before talking about some of the very interesting things you've done, perhaps we could go through the names of your predecessor as head of department was Professor Daniel Musser.
Yes.
And under his direction...
He developed Commonwealth literature.
Exactly, exactly.
Yes, and post-colonial literature.
Which has now become quite an important pillar.
It has become an important part of our honours program.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And then you became head of department, and as we know, your area is romantic literature, modernism, and comparative literature. Yeah. After you, Professor Ivan Kalous.
Yes, Professor Kalous, who has done a lot in his own quiet way for the development of the department in the terms of literary theory. He is himself a, let me put it this way, a dyed-in-the-wool literary theorist on Foucault and Derrida and Blanchot. And he's moved the department in that direction too, which is important, because this is the sort of the trend nowadays in most universities.
Absolutely.
And now, recently, quite recently, well, in October, Dr. James Corby was voted in as head of the department, and he's now. And James Corby is very interested in modern poetry, contemporary poetry, and contemporary literature. So he's moving in that direction too. Everybody adds a little bit to the house, as it were.
Yes, absolutely. That's a fascinating part.
That's yes.
And the good thing about
that
change.
That is the way it has to be. Yes. There must be some kind of development. At the same time, I always insist on this myself, you must have a canonical part, which acts as ballast to the ship. And those are the old traditional stuff which has made Oxford and Cambridge so popular. It's almost impossible to get into Oxford and Cambridge. Well, not impossible, very difficult, because they've kept the traditional standard. They've improved and they've moved elsewhere and they've expanded rather than improved. But
the basic pillars
are there. Yeah. Those are the foundation stones and they've got to be there. I sincerely believe in that. Because, of course, sometimes you get some universities, you know, you'd be surprised. In some universities, I won't mention names, I've been told by external examiners, you can take a degree in English literature without doing Shakespeare. And if I may be sarcastic, you can also take a degree in English literature by doing junk studies. So that's out as far as I'm concerned.
You consider that the basic canon as the basis.
It must be respected and must be upheld. Exactly. That's definite.
Well, in the last few minutes that we have, I'd like to sort of go into more of what you do, where you're coming from. As you say, you're coming from this more sort of classic English literature background. And just to tell us a little bit about what you've been doing lately, those main points in your career which really you feel have made it all worth it.
Yes, obviously there's a great joy in... Because when you're dealing with the great writers like Shelley, Byron, Keats, Blake, and Coleridge, you're not just dealing with text. You are, as it were, entering the mind of a person, the superior mind, the genius of a person. You're in contact, and the mind sometimes possesses you. and that's the fun of that's the greatness, as everything else does. I could be a scientist, and my subject, let us see, whatever it is, anatomy, would sort of engage me so much that I'd become almost obsessed. That is the academic. That's, you have to do that. Then, of course, I was interested in British writers abroad, because now it's very difficult to write something original about the established writers, as you know. So you have to seek elsewhere. And there's a lot of British writers and their work and their inspiration from Italy. And I've, of course, published a book on that, The British Writers and the Experience of Italy. And now I'm interested also in myth and mythology. How the old myths of old, let's say the archetypal myth, reemerge in modern literature. Say, the Persephone myth, which reemerges in Lawrence. You can see why. Because his father was a miner from the underworld, and the king of the underworld takes over the queen who and the woman who is a rather superior teacher and wins her over. Rephrasing, re-establishing, reworking the kind of rifacimento of the old Greek notions of mythology into modern English literature. And it's going on and on. The Orpheus myth, for example. That's fascinating. Orpheus. What does it mean, Orpheus? The power of music to enchant. Because Orpheus originally came from the north of Greece, sort of beyond the mountains, ultramontane, and they were rather savage there. So in Thrace. I think it's the substitution of the drums, the war drums, for melody, and the way it works, and so many other. And I think that I'm interested also in the Freudian and Jungian interpretation of the archetype. That really interests me too.
And you're writing about that now.
I'm writing about that now. Well, I'm assembling material. Yes. Because you first assemble your material, and it starts with a lot of sort of card index notes, and then you put them all together. Then you somehow establish an order.
Your card index box must be very large.
Oh, it's enormous.
And also, we mentioned before your interest in Anglo-Italian. studies. Well, I mean, this has been a very successful,
extremely successful
part of your, journal, your academic work.
Oh yes, the journal has been accepted, has been recognised as in the directory of the Modern Language Association of America, which is very high powered directory, as one of the learned journals there. So it's found its place there. And we've had the good fortune, to put it this way, of having contributions, papers, published from the leading scholars in the field. And that has really done us proud.
And you have a biennial conference,
Yes, a biennial conference. We had one recently on the Grand Tour and Beyond.
I'm always fascinated when I have come to attend the conference. The connections that are made are just superb. I mean, things you wouldn't dream of.
Yeah, and it's good because then you're not only, you're moving away from your teaching mode to your learning mode. You learn. You learn from other people's papers. You engage with them. You consider things again. And you ask questions and get answers. And it's vital to have these conferences going. And I, for example, spoke about Blake's illustration of the Francesca da Rimini episode in Dante's Inferno, the illustration, comparing it with Dante Gabriele Rossetti's painting of the same episode. So it's interesting to see as a part of byproduct of the Grand Tour, because then Italy becomes very important and very central in the English imagination, as Dante does.
And plans for the future, apart from your book on myths? Got anything else boiling there and bubbling?
Yes, there are quite a few things on the back burner. I've had to buy a new cooker. I'll be presenting a paper now in next week, next Friday, on the classical pastoral elegy and assimilation and appropriation by Milton in Lycidas. Why does Milton take an old-fashioned convention to express new thoughts? And whether you can have the expression of originality in something which is a convention. The difference between convention and originality. Can you be original using an old convention?
That's a wonderful idea. And with that, I'm afraid we're going to have to close. Our time is up. Thank you so much, Professor Felice Barsaldo, coming to talk to us on University Matters today.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. Il-programm li għadkom kemm smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.